Welcome to the Lead Lifestyle Podcast, where we believe men need to get out of the rut of working non-stop and putting themselves last. So whether you're in higher management, a corporate exec, or a small business owner, it's time you start improving your health, your relationships, and your mindset. And I'm going to interview the best minds in the world so you can do exactly that. You'll learn their philosophy, their daily routines, and you'll get some real practical advice so you can reach peak physical health, defy aging, and live a life you love. And this is the Lead Lifestyle. So my guest today is Dan Iles. He's a senior communications manager at the Soil Association. He works with the farming team to inspire and equip farmers in the UK towards agroecological farming techniques. He's also an advocate for market gardening. He's a chef, and he's just got some really interesting insights into the food supply chain, what we can do to improve urban farming, and what you can do to improve your diet and your impact on your local community. So enjoy this episode. Over to me and Dan. So Dan, thanks for coming on today. Really looking forward to the conversations we're going to have. We were getting into a few things before we press record on your passions, really. You said that you're a big advocate in market gardening, and you did an apprenticeship in Canada. Just kind of for people who don't know what it is, like, can you define it, and then how did you get interested in it in the first place?
So market gardening, or at least is the idea of growing food for communities on a small acreage, so generally between an acre and 5 acres of land. And there's different forms about market gardening, but one that's more popular now where you try and grow a larger variety of everyone's vegetables. So you're trying to make sure that you can do what's called a whole farm diet. So you're trying to grow. So people also have chickens with eggs, and they also like sometimes have ruminants like sheep or beef or whatever. And that also adds into the whole farm system, because then you get facility from the shit of the animals, and you also get eggs and other things. Market gardening, traditionally they sell at farmers markets. They occasionally sell vegetables to restaurants because they like the higher quality vegetables that come from that sort of market garden, and they also sell to box schemes. And that's where where you'll get your weekly veg box order. So quite often there's market gardens across the country that already operate, you know, that you order a box and you either pick it up or it gets delivered.
So is the idea that it's completely self-sufficient and you're not like buying produce from abroad or from another town? Or
it depends on the what the customer wants, really. You can get just a supplement to your, like, sometimes you would also want to go to the supermarket and buy vegetables as well, or whatever supplies. But the vegetables that generally it's a way of like having a bit more connection. When you do buy a market garden, you're having a bit more connection with a local vegetable producer. And quite often you can go and visit them and chat with the farmer and see where your vegetables come from and get a bit more of an intimate connection. So there's the built into this idea of being a market gardener is redeveloping local supply chains. So you're not just buying from, like, quite often salad from that's grown in Spain or Morocco, or like, you know, green beans grown in Kenya or asparagus grown in Peru. You're buying seasonal vegetables when they're ready. You're talking, you know, the farmer they come from. You may have spent a day or two volunteering on that land, and you're eating, like, you know, good quality vegetables. Generally, the market gardening can be organic or it can be not organic, but lots of farmers who are market gardeners are organic, so that means they don't use pesticides or herbicides, and they tend to work with nature rather than using lots of inputs. And some market gardeners do a thing called no dig, which is where you try to have as minimal soil disturbance as possible. And that's with the understanding that the more you disturb the soil, the more you disrupt the acquire a balanced ecosystem. of fungi and organisms under the soil that people don't really know much about because people haven't paid much attention to it. Most farmers, a lot of farmers just spray nitrogen down, they spray, you know, NPK down on the soil and they just expect it to react because that's kind of a basic way of it working. But there's so much complexity under the soil that people don't understand and they're learning about every day. So yeah, that's quite interesting. Like trying to find a way of farming the soil so you can, and then the soil, I guess, helps you out as it goes on. It creates that resilience to the crop. It creates freshness and the sweetness of the fruit, that sort of thing.
Wow, it's kind of like the microbiome in the human gut. Then how it mm-hmm. responds to, you can't just hammer it with kind of junk and then expect it to turn around after you've had an Actimel. You've got to spend like a year of fasting and rebuilding your microbiome and it can affect mood and everything else. So with soil, is that the same where it can affect the environment, the kind of little bugs and worms and things in the soil and how that affects the birds who feed on them and everything else and then the
crater?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So more people talk about, it's a growing movement, you may have heard of it, called like regenerative agriculture. And it's all the idea is in contrast to what other people know as degenerative agriculture. So if you're constantly using without paying back, if you're extracting nutrients, if you're growing and just putting a very basic form, I guess to make that comparison back to the gut health, you're just like, yeah, the sugars and things that like don't have any complexity, then you're going to deplete that ecosystem, that's that complex ecosystem that's there. It's amazing. Like there's a lot of people who do experiments and they do like, they sometimes simple ones, sometimes quite complex ones, but they do like trial pots of like not disturbing the soil and other things. And then ones where they do like do some basic disturbance or they add chemicals or whatever. And it's amazing to see that it does have a big difference.
Plowing a field, was that a disturbance?
Yeah, plowing a field will be a disturbance. So in my job, I work with arable farmers as well as horticultural farmers and livestock farmers. But there's a growing number of people who are in the arable sector who are doing like cereals and other things that are trying to minimize plowing because it does not just affect the soil health, but it also disturbs the carbon store, because soil is a carbon sink as well. So if you plow the soil, disturbs all the fungus and all the other organisms, and they start to release that carbon they've been storing rather than like keep it in.
So when they're cutting into, this is a massive tangent.
Yeah, we can go back.
When they're cutting into like the green belt, you know, in Manchester, and then they're putting down like 1,000 new build homes. Obviously, that's massive soil disturbance because they tend to build like a groundwork foundation and then put the house on top. Is that then? That's obviously gone as an opportunity to farm it because there's buildings on top. But has that damaged the environment itself by making that much disturbance?
Yeah, I mean, there's a. It's a big problem, isn't it? A big question about building new homes is that we obviously need new homes. But then if you look at cities and the way they used to interact, there was around in the green belt around cities, there was used to be a thriving market garden culture. And so the soils around those cities are some of the most healthy soils that you can find. You know, that there's really good levels of organic soil matter in there. There's really good,
just untapped.
Exactly, biodiversity. There's definitely a sadness when you like concrete over and put some buildings on top because you're losing that potential. And also not just the potential, but because proximity to the urban center, so which creates like not just positive in terms of like not transporting things very far, but also that interaction between the populace and the farm and rural life, which is a big thing. You know, people need that link to food growing and rural society because without it, I believe they feel poorer, you know, sort of spiritually, although I'm not a spiritual person, but
I know what you mean. That is a tangent that I can speak about, because I basically grew up on like a really kind of smallholding farm type thing, so I've had a lot of experience with that. I just need to understand, what's the difference between arable and horticultural?
So arable is a sort of farm, generally bigger. So I think there's normally looking at hundreds of acres rather than a few acres, although it can be different. But generally, you're focusing on growing cereals. So you're talking like wheat, barley, maize, those sort of like things that you can do with big machines. And you generally need to grow a lot of it to be able to make a good margin. Whereas horticulture is the focus on vegetables or flowers or things that you can grow on a big scale. Quite often you can have field scale farms that are horticulture, but they tend to be not, you know, you can have, you know, in the Midwest, you can have arable farms that are thousands of acres, you know, with these, you know, many people know this huge kind of spraying machines or combine harvesters that just do like, I don't know, 30 or 40 meters at a time. So that's a kind of different. And then there's also the livestock farming, which is, you know, tends to be, kind of either dairy or beef cattle or sheep. But then, of course, just to add another clarification, there is more farmers. Well, it used to be that you'd be an arable farmer and a livestock farmer and sometimes a vegetable farmer at the same time. Because, like, going back to this whole farm system, is that the farming system has been encouraged to separate and specialize with quite technical machinery and inputs or whatever. But all of that works under a sort of a globalized, corporatized system. But if you layer up different activities, so you've got livestock on the farm, you've got arable on the farm, you've got vegetables. Each one of those brings things to the farm, like fertility, or it might do some soil disturbance in a good way that encourages certain growth back into the farm, or you might be able to build fertility with a certain crop or provide protein for an animal with a certain crop. So all those things
are positive. And is it a year-round thing then, where like you can't grow maize all year round, and during the season that you can't grow it, you could grow something else?
Exactly. Yeah. Or you could grow some sort of cereal crop. When you've harvested it, you could then bring your animals on to eat the stubble, and then those animals are shitting on the ground, and that fertility then is being used in the following year by the next crop of plants to grow. Rather than having to use nitrogen fertilizers, which mimic what was traditionally for hundreds and hundreds of years, or since the dawn of agriculture, maybe being like got from animal manure. Instead, farmers can just spray on large amounts of nitrogen fertilizers or whatever to mimic that. And it's easier in many ways for them, but in the short term, but in longer term, you end up depleting the soil bank, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there can't be as complex a series of bacteria in a man-made fertilizer as a manure.
Yeah, and it's slow release. Manure is slow release compared to like fertilizer, which is just liquid. And when it rains, it washes away into the rivers. You lose a lot of that nutrients that you would want to put on plants. So there's a lot that you're sort of not getting, and it's more harmful for lots of things. I mean, I get it. I get why farmers use it. I don't think they're bad people. But it's just the way that farming has changed in the last 60 years where farmers have been encouraged by corporations, I believe, to specialize further and further and further and have tighter and tighter margins, and have bigger and bigger farms and bigger machines, and rely more and more on inputs.
You'd have to like a million sheep eating your field in America.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
So how is it cheaper then to go to Aldi and get a lettuce for 20p than to go around the corner and buy it from someone, you know, with an allotment? Like how is that? Is it mainly like efficiency and profit? That's why it's imported from Spain and Morocco, like you said, or wherever?
So there's a word in economics called externalities, which I don't fully understand because I didn't do loads of economics. But from what I understand is it, if when you're growing, when you're buying a lettuce in Aldi's, you're not paying the real cost, the true cost of that lettuce, because the companies that are making it are getting away with, you know, not paying their workers a fair wage. They're generally working, quite often the lettuce is grown in Morocco or south of Spain on labor, which is paid like very drastically low wages. So that's one factor. They're not paying the cost of the environmental destruction that they're reaping on the environment, on the world, by growing it in a cheap and quick way. So they will be depleting the soil health. They'll be using lots of chemicals. They'll be doing things that, in many ways they should be paying for because someone else is having to remove that down the line or suffer from it. So it can't go on forever. So at some point, these finite resources that they're depleting will become an issue and we'll all have to deal with them. So there's that. And I guess also because the way that the global food system has become a globalized system, where quantities of scale can be so huge. So you can have these farms that have such huge, have thousands, hundreds of acres of salad and a big plastic, they're called plasticos in South Spain, aren't they? You know, they just goes on and on and on and on for miles.
The polytunnel things.
Exactly. Yeah. The polytunnels. Yeah. Yeah. You just can get that scale that you wouldn't, that most farmers wouldn't be able to get. If you're just growing it on a market garden on your allotment, you're not able to put that.
You probably couldn't put a 5-mile polytunnel anywhere in the UK.
No, although I went to the Isle of Wight to do some filming not long ago and saw some of the tomato houses they have down there. And they have like, I don't know, like 30 or 40 hectares of green glass houses, which is pretty impressive. We've got a drone up going over, which is pretty impressive. Oh, and I would argue that some of the stuff they're doing there is quite interesting and it's not all bad. Sometimes using technology and quantitative scale is good. But the problem is that in my experience, the broader I think it works in everything. The more you zoom out from things, the more you don't actually look at the details. And those details are where waste happens. And it's fine. You can, if you're making money, you don't need to focus on that waste or those problems because it just all adds up. But as soon as something snaps, like we're seeing it now, kind of with the gas crisis, you know, like it's all based on these abattoirs that are based on carbon dioxide to kill animals. And as soon as something changes in the global economy, which means that the carbon dioxide isn't available to kill the animals, and all the slaughterhouses are very much based on all the abattoirs have been closed down locally, so there's only like these ones or two or three in like huge areas. So it just means that, and that's not a good example for vegetables because it's gone to the meat, but it means that like everything's based on it all working in a very sort of capitalist way. And as soon as one thing snaps, it is not resilient to survive. And then everything goes wrong. Mm. But whereas if you're a small scale farmer, so if you're like working on an acre or 2 acres, you're getting more value out of the same land because you're able to focus on that land. So therefore, you're able to to do the detailed work systems in place, work with nature in a very interesting way to save input. So you're not putting, your nature's doing the work for you.
So you can optimize several streams of growing rather than just making one really efficient and cheap.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
How did you, and I imagine it tastes better as well. I wonder if there's a link between the taste of a food and the healthiness of the food. Like if I'm having a bland, watery lettuce that's been imported versus one that I've grown myself in my own garden, am I going to get more nutrients from it? I wonder if anyone's done that.
I think there has been. I don't know too much about the science, but people do talk about how there are more nutrients. If you just imagine that interaction that there is between a plant and its soil biology, it's not. everything is all more interlinked than we think. We just like to think of it, growing food is almost a mechanical way, and it's happening more and more with like vertical farming, where people just grow salads indoors in like hydroponics or whatever. They just believe that plants just need like 6 or 7 nutrients, you know, that you just wham in, nitrogen, phosphate, etc., potassium, and then that just creates, you know, a vegetable at the end of the day. But there's so much more, you know, biology is so much more complex than that, than our sort of basic understanding. And by doing that, I don't know the science, so I can't talk on it, but I know that people do say about it, the nutrients is not being good enough. And also you're just getting sort of quite often a vegetable that's not going to last as long in your fridge. Quite often it could be limp and lifeless. Like, yeah, most people, everyone has to do the thing where they try a carrot from like, you know, but basics bag of in Tesco's, and then try a carrot, like organic carrot with dirt on it still. You know, and then see the difference. There is a same with tomatoes. Like, you know, you buy a tomato green in winter that's not meant to be there. You're not really meant to be eating it because it's been kind of ripened by hormones, and you know, it's created a gas house. You know, they put fuel into the greenhouse.
Yeah, I've done that tomato one. It's like a taste explosion.
When exactly.
It's like,
yeah,
homegrown. It's such a deep and rich taste. And I was only probably like 12, 13 when I remember doing it. And so, you know, your taste buds and your palate isn't as fully developed then. So, yeah, I can't eat like crap tomatoes and stuff. And you know, having run a gym for so long, so many people think that salad is the way to get lean, and no one bloody likes salad. And probably a reason is the how you're making a salad and what you're buying has no taste to it. So then psychologically, you're not going to stick to your diet. You're going to go and have something like, you know, a biscuit or a cake, because it's actually got some sugary dopamine release in your brain rather than actually having a nice salad.
So when I was working on my garden in Canada, we would do a farmer's market every Saturday, actually on a Sunday as well. But one of the things we'd have, so we'd grow these little tomatoes called Sun Golds, and they were little yellow tomatoes. They don't really work for a corporate supply chain because they don't last much longer than 4 or 5 days. And if you have a tomato, generally the tomatoes that are the vegetables, this is an interesting thing. Again, it's like the vegetables that we have in our supermarkets, they're not built for taste. They're built for their capacity to travel.
Right.
So the apples, if you think about it, so it's a bit of a convoluted way of the story, but there's 5 or 6 apples that you might know, like, you know, I can't remember the names, but, you know,
Granny Smith,
you know, Bramble, exactly, all those ones. Yeah. They're there because they're good at, but there's hundreds and hundreds of apples, or thousands, maybe, of varieties, but they might like go a bit ripe or soft or whatever. Same with tomatoes. Like, there's probably about, you know, you've got your vine tomatoes, you've got your beef, you've got your other sort of those classic rounds. And these Sun Golds, they are perfect because, you know, you hand them out to people as they pass to you. So one of our techniques to get people into the store was we just hand out like one tomato each to people going past. And you could count the steps. They'd walk like about 4 or 5 steps, munch it, and then they'd just turn around and then come back and buy a box because it's like candy. You know, it was just...
And it's like only available for 4 days.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no. Sorry, so they grow through the year. Well, they grow through the summer season, but they wouldn't last in your fridge much longer than four. They would go a little bit wrinkly. But it's just that glory of being able to be close to your farm, so you don't need to, so you can get that variety and that exquisiteness You know, we were growing in that farm. We were growing about 15 or 20 different tomato varieties, and some of them were the big heritage tomatoes. If you tried a heritage tomato,
I don't think so. No,
they're like these. Quite often, you'll have them on like a salad in Italy. You know, they're sliced like a beef tomato.
Oh yeah,
they're more knobbly. They're not as uniform. They like come and they have ridges all around them. And when you grow them, they get kind of almost overripe. But then you slice them like that laterally, so you see that amazing shape that you get in tomatoes when you strip them. But because they're knobbly, it looks even more beautiful because it's just kind of chaotic. There's different colors as well. There's oranges and greens and blacks. And it's just like, oh, it's there's a taste of that. It's just, it makes all the hard work of farming worth it when you chew into that.
How did you first get into market gardening, or what kind of were the steps that got you into thinking about this and wanting to pursue it as a bit of a career?
I keep on asking myself that question. I've always been interested in food. Like since I was 5 or 6, I was cooking. So I love eating. I love cooking food. I really am passionate about the politics of food. I didn't grow much food. My parents have a big garden, so we didn't really grow any food when I was growing up. And I didn't have much interaction with farms, but I guess when you're eating good, when you like the taste of food and you like cooking food, it's not long before you realize that like almost half the cooking, or perhaps I would say, I would argue like 70 or 80% of cooking is done in the field. You know, it's all like, you know, it's all the flavor and everything and the crunch and everything is built into the vegetable very early. So that's why the best chefs in Italy or whatever around the world are the ones that have the best sourcing contracts with farmers that get the best ingredients. So I guess as my understanding of like quality ingredients grew, I became more interested in farming. And also, I guess I was a food campaigner in London, looking at kind of international solidarity with farmers across the world, and campaigning against kind of the over corporatization, kind of stopping the takeover of the food system, of the further takeover of the food system by corporations. And we were talking a lot with farmers then, and talking about this concept called food sovereignty, which is all about trying to get more control. People, consumers, farmers, citizens trying to take back control of the food system. And I guess that made me interact more with this movement of people that are trying to change the food system. And a lot of those are small growers. So in London, there's a market garden / community center called Organically. And they were really inspiring. I used to go and volunteer with them kind of once every week or once every couple of weeks. And it was up in Walthamstow, northeast London. And they'd taken over a glass, like sort of an old tree nursery or something like that, like with some glass houses. And they had about, I don't know, it was quite urban, but they had about 4 or 5 acres of land. So it got a sizable space in, you know, not central London, but, you know, in a kind of a urban area.
Wow.
And what was amazing about it and what inspired me about it is the way that the potential that growing food has to bring people together. So, you know, they were getting some charitable income, so getting money from grants, but they were making a lot of their money from selling to restaurants and market gardens and so to markets and other things, veg box schemes. But then they were using that money to employ a community organizer, so that was getting people because it's quite a diverse area in Walthamstow, all different sorts of communities and people of color and working class communities and middle class communities. And everyone was coming and they were using that sort of this medium of food growing to bring people onto the farm to do volunteer work. And quite often the times that I did volunteer on them, I had the best conversations because you're focusing on picking, or you're focusing on generally quite a mundane task. It's not so easy on your body. But in that time, because the focus is there, you don't have to think about like the awkwardness of a conversation. You can have like periods of silence that are kind of calm and not awkward. And then through that, you can talk to these people from different communities, different walks of life. And I had these most amazing conversations and connections with people through that farm.
Wow.
And got really inspired by the sort of activities they were doing and the things they were doing. And I guess there's a few other farms and other things that have inspired me over time, but I got really inspired by this idea of the farm as a social center. So it's not just about growing food. It's about bringing people together. And since then I've really wanted to, figure out a way in which I could make that work myself. So I could use food growing to provide food for the community around me, to provide a space for the community around me to interact with, and to provide everyone with a connection with nature, which I believe creates that spiritual energy that I, again, I'm not a spiritual person, but like it creates that like connection that we all crave for, because we are born of the environment and we spend less and less time in the environment. And we spend more and more time indoors or on our screens or whatever. And you might, it might be discomforting. You might not feel very comfortable to do sometimes when you're out and about, it's raining or whatever. But that time that you do spend, you do commit to doing things like just spending a day pulling carrots out of carrot weeds out on a rainy day and when it's really bleak outside, that when you come back in and you're hungry, you're properly hungry, you want to eat, like, and you know, you sleep really well, you go to bed and bam, you're out, and then you wake up, you know, there's no sort of like thoughts of like sort of anxiety thoughts or like, you know, that sort of racing brain.
What do the carrots think of me?
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, again, like the way I liked, so interrupt me if I'm getting a little bit convoluted here, but
go for it.
Like the farming has become, so sometimes farming can be a very lonely thing. You know, I talked to a lot of farmers in my job who are arable farmers, and a lot of that involves sitting in a tractor cab. And just, people might have watched Jeremy Clarkson's farm, you know, show recently. Like, it's just like a lot of the job is just sitting there and just doing row after row after row in separated in your own little hermetically sealed environment. And that's why quite often farmers on Twitter or whatever, because they're just like, you know, they're obviously focusing on, because quite often things are also automated in the cab as well, but you just got to sort of be there just in case things go wrong. So what I really enjoy about this different movement of farming is about, like, it's about quite often these things that we think have saved us labor or they've made things easier have actually disconnected us from people. People talk about Guy Watson, who's one of the founders of Riverford, talks about how, like, he sees, you know, especially when people are cutting hay in the summer, like it used to be a big community job. You know, you'd, every farmer would lend a hand on one farm to cut the hay. There'd be a big barrel of cider at the end of the day, and people would normally, it'd be hard work. And I've done a day of hay baling. Have you done a day of hay baling? It's like, it's really, you know, it's good exercise as well.
Yeah.
It's a good work.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt, but yeah, that was every single summer of my youth was, we'd do my granddad's field and then we'd go and do his mate's farm, and it was huge. And then we'd go down the road, and, you know, like everyone had like a designated day. And yeah, it's exhausting. And I genuinely think that, in the gym and with strongman training and playing rugby, they were essential like years of my physical development, because I can pick anything up off the ground and chuck it up as if on a trailer.
And
you'd be like 11 years old and getting drunk on like a cider shandy or something. At the time I hated it, but looking back, they're like some of the fondest memories, because of the conversations, and we'd meet family friends who lived, you know, 5 miles down the road, who you'd never see. You'd only see when it was like hay baling time. So yeah, there has to be a community element to that, because it's just too difficult to do as a one-man job.
Yeah, but nowadays it is possible, because the machines create that efficiency. It's cheaper to buy a machine, have a huge scale, than it is to employ or like lend a hand or have a community of people around you, because it's just more complicated. And you know, farmers maybe making more margins because of it, but they're probably lonely, and there's increasing problems of mental health crisis, and there's things that are going on that, you know,
that's always been an issue, because farmers tend to be firearms holders as well, so being depressed and having access, you know, there's always been a lot of suicides. Like I know some boys who've committed suicide back in South Wales when we were at school. You know, there was quite a few.
Yeah.
So if it's getting worse, and it is as a whole society, and especially in men's suicides, the suicide rate's increasing, isn't it? So if it's getting worse in farmers, I can imagine it's quite bad, quite frequent.
Yeah. No, I think, I don't know about this. Again, I don't see the stats, but I know that, this tale, and internationally also is a story, you know, of farmers, more and more farmers going to debt. And it's that debt that not just
they're on that fine line.
Exactly. Yeah. And what it means, and what is, again, that's the thing that I come with my job, is that people, the debt creates control. It means they can't take risks to change. They know what, quite often farmers know, they don't like the inputs they use. They don't like the fact they have to rely on so many big machines or whatever. They like the simpler farming that their grandfather was doing. But they can't move back because they're constantly hooked into this like margin.
The banks want you to be in debt.
Exactly, yeah. They're hooked into this margins hunting yield, focusing on the yield rather than focusing on reducing costs and reducing waste, which you could do if you have a little bit of income investment to be able to like invest in that innovative solution or that system that might save you time in the long run. So
through all those experiences, you said that you went to Canada and you did an apprenticeship in market gardening, to wrap up all our tangents.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll come back to a few of them. When was that? Like, how old were you? Where were you in your career? And what opportunity was there to go to Canada in the first
place? So I was working in London. Me and my partner were both working in London before that, both working for jobs that we thought were our dream jobs, and they were kind of our dream jobs. I was working as a campaigner on food justice, and I knew that I need to get out of London. It's a lovely, amazing place, but it's a stressful place. And when you leave for a couple of weeks, you realize that you feel that stress pouring off you. And I was kind of having a little bit of a mental breakdown, I'd say. I was, having a really hard time. I didn't really realize it until too late. But so I knew that even before the mental breakdown, I knew that I needed a bit of a change and have a bit of I was sort of coming towards the end of my 20s, and I wanted to like have a big break and something exciting to do before this like big settling down thing that, we have to do, even though I don't necessarily think that's the right thing anymore. We went to west coast of Canada, we had some money before. So we spent 6 months just like road tripping and volunteering on what's called woofing, which is where you volunteer your time on organic farms. And they, in return, they give you free accommodation and free food. So what's you spend called, like sorry? Woofing.
Woofing.
It's double W.
Yeah.
OOFING.
Okay.
I think it's Worldwide Organic Something. You can Google
I'll
it.
Find it.
So you spend like in that time, you work like four or five hours a day for like 4 days a week. So it's not that hard. It's hard. It's the time you do it, can be hard. But then you get like 3 good meals a day. I was at the time I was working on the first place we went to was this amazing place, which is on an island off an island off an island. In outside of like around Vancouver Island, a place called Cortez Island, and it was there's this farm, this guy in the middle of nowhere in this like surrounded by forest, like a 3 mile track from the town. So it was like really remote. Didn't have a Wi-Fi reception. There was like one of those crappy little dial up modems that you had to get any internet, and you'd have the limited time. You wouldn't be able.
You think you'd made a huge mistake going down that track?
Well, you do, but actually it's that glory of being disconnected,
Yeah.
You don't need the connection that we all have. Obviously, it's good, but generally, like, it means we encourage us away from the connection with people around us and our environment. But, in that farm, we were getting up sometimes at, like, 5 in the morning. We'd go and hand milk the cows. They had 3 dairy cows that they hand-milked, and that was an amazing experience in itself. Just like going into the barn, that sort of energy, you'd be able to sense the energy of whatever's happening the night before. Sometimes if like a cow was on heat or something, you'd know it because like everyone would be pissed off. And then you'd milk a cow and then go back with that milk. And then someone else would be cooking breakfast. So you'd have you'd be really fucking hungry and ready for it by 8 a.m. You'd have like a great breakfast and then start a farming day. But so we're doing that for that sort of thing for about 6 or 7 weeks. And then we did another 4 or 5 months of traveling. And then after that, I spent 6 months living in a collective house in Vancouver where I was being a community organizer there.
Was that back in the city then?
Yeah, back in the city, yeah. We met some friends, and those friends lived in a collective house. There's 12 people living all in one big house. And so that's kind of another story, but it was an interesting experience. And it was also interesting being a community organizer. But like after 6 months of, Ellen and I had basically come to Canada with the idea, we had working visas, because you can get, when you're under 30, you can get these things called a working experience holiday, I think. And it's a two-year visa. And we had this idea that we'd be able to get jobs in line with our careers in Canada.
Yeah.
But it soon turned out that we couldn't really get them, because most employers they saw the fact that we had 2 year visas and thought like, oh, I don't really want to invest in this person. And so really like the visas, kind of the best thing the visa's for is like the hospitality industry or working in a restaurant or a shop or whatever.
Yeah. Where it's easy to rehire someone.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So after like a while of trying to find these jobs, these jobs that were in line with our careers, we just thought, actually, this isn't really working for us. Let's do something which is like building on the experience we had in the first part of the trip. We were doing volunteering, but actually doing it properly sort of immersing ourselves in this experience. And also I've been playing around with this idea, kind of flirting with the idea of like being a farmer in the future, and like not quite sure whether I'd enjoy the toil, and it's hard work, you know. So I wanted to give it the test and see if my body could work and my mental health would. So yeah, so we found this farm in on Vancouver Island again, managed to successfully apply. It was, I don't think I was ever really able to make my mind up. I don't really think I still don't know. It's the thing about farming is that like, or my gardening is, well, the first 2 weeks were a most amazing workout. I mean, you should, you know, get everyone to have a go in your gym, because it's like we were like, our bodies were completely like smashed to pieces. Like just bending over, picking with your legs straight and like back bent, the thigh work that does. And I mean, just bearing in mind, my thighs had been withered away after like years of office work. So I'm definitely not, I mean, lots of people who have more manual jobs would be fine. But I was like on a sort of crash course to actually using my body properly for the first time.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible experience, and something I really, appreciated was like this idea that our bodies are made to work. Well, they're not all, they are generally made to move, you know, they're made to, we generally to survive.
The way that we live nowadays is not the way we were designed
That's
work.
A good way of putting it.
There's a really good book called 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back. I think it's by Esther Gokaley, and all the steps are like how to actually sit, how to actually sleep, how to actually walk, and all the pictures are like you know, African women working in the fields, and like you say, they'd be bending over with their knees locked out and kind of feet gripping the ground, toes gripping the ground, and there's an arch in the foot and the back's perfectly straight. And then I literally teach people how to lift things up off the floor in the gym. No one can do that position. No one.
Yeah.
And they wonder why they've got sore backs. Well, actually, that's how it's supposed to function, and yours is like half the length in terms of the tissue.
Because it's that core exercise, isn't it? Like, you know, a lot of these techniques that we do in, I don't know, Pilates or whatever, are ones that farmers or growers that are using their hands all the time have to do all the time, because they're having to spend long time in like the same position.
Yeah, there's probably no other way of doing that for 8 hours.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so you get, you know, I mean, you know, there still probably was imbalances, because my knees started getting a bit dodgy, because I'd be bending down, I was crouching to pick some carrot weeds, some weeds from carrots, and then my knees would start to get a bit dodgy. So I then end up standing up and leaning over, like bending it down with my legs sort of straight. And then I'd get tired of that. So I just generally like sort of revert. And
something like, do I really want to be a farmer?
Exactly. There's sometimes where you're like, fuck this, you know, like it was just completely, there's one particularly bleak day where there's forest fires in Canada. So the air was thick with smog, like forest smog. And the managers somehow had, because they were having a bit of a crisis in leadership, they were having some arguments. So they decided on that day of all days to choose to go to a coffee shop down the road and have a big discussion, probably an argument about the future of their farm, leaving us, the employees, in this thick sort of post-apocalyptic sort of world, trying to like harvest potatoes with our hands. We didn't have any equipment, really. We had a subsoiler, like, this tractor went over and subsoiled the land, dug the sort of disturbed the potatoes, and then we were like scrabbling around the dirt with our fingernails being broken by these stones, like picking up these like sort of potatoes that were quite blighted because they'd been, that had a, the crop had a bit of blight on it. And it was just the worst. It was like, so we're like, fuck you. The guys that that were the farmers who were like, why didn't you just like be there with this? It's like, we're probably damaging our lungs, like past repair, you know, with all this smoke in the air.
Wow.
Anyway, but yeah, there was also some amazing times, as I said before, like just like, you know, the idea of just, it, sometimes it is monotonous and it is tiring. Other times you can focus on things like, you know, I had to do, sometimes you have to do an hour and a half watering in the propagation house, which is the house, the kind of a sort of greenhouse where you put the young plants before they go out in the fields, all in little plugs. Yeah. We had to make sure they were constantly moist. So we would have a little water wand and we'd go over the whole area, and it would take a long time, but you'd have your headphones on and you'd be listening to some podcast or listening to something like an audiobook. And it was just a really nice way of, again, it was kind of work because you had to like a sort of rhythmical sort of waving exercise with your hand. And then you were learning about things at the same time and you were doing work. It was a, because you didn't have to think too much because it was monotonous, but you could have the relaxation and the space to sort of take your time.
I think there's a real value in jobs where you can stand back at the end and go, ah, you know, that's what I've done. You know, there's a visible result.
Oh, totally. Work. Yeah. 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 I spend my job right now, you know, I could spend a day like pushing information, like sending emails or like repackaging words from one area to another area, like sending out a tweet or a video or whatever. And you don't, you know, I guess you can see the view count on your YouTube thing, or you can see like the retweets.
Might just be Chinese bots though.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's not gratifying. It's not gratifying. Seeing like, you know, seeing stuff grow in front of you, like seeing a wall or like seeing the animals being enjoying their environment or the things that you do around with farming, it's just so, it's so gratifying. I mean, obviously it's also really, can be really scary. And, you know, when you plant something and it doesn't work, or a pest comes that you didn't expect, or a disease, and it decimates this crop that would have been a beautiful, wonderful thing, and you put lots of hard work into it, it can also be really infuriating. But quite often people call the thing about market gardening is kind of like spread betting. You right. plant, you do loads of stuff, yeah. loads of different varieties. And with the knowledge that every season is different, you know, every season will be hotter or colder, there'll be more rain or less rain, and that will encourage different diseases and pests. And you just have to make sure that, like, there's some things win and other things, and that's enough to pay for the things that lose.
So you can make a living doing it in the UK?
I don't think you can. North America is different, I think, because in North America, the food system is so much worse than our food system. We're going that way because of Brexit and the trade agreements that we're having, because we're having to get closer and closer in with that situation. Well, we may go that way. Let's just say that probably the jury's out on that one. But because the mainstream food is generally lower quality, there's more space for like higher quality vegetables that come from market gardens, and it's probably a bit more of a, maybe because of the like pioneering culture back in the 1900s and the 1800s of people going out and having to farm their own vegetables and that sort of market. There's a bit more of a market culture, a market garden culture, where people would go, like there'd be like 6-7 different market farmers.
You know, I was watching something ages ago, sorry to interrupt, Dan.
Yeah.
And I, for the life of me, I can't remember. All the way through this, I've been trying to remember what I was watching. I can't remember at all, but it was saying like after World War II, all the kind of young people, maybe it was World War I, there was such a a lower amount of available workforce because of all the deaths from and injuries from war, that the government was like, right, they were buying people houses. Like, there was like a grant for a house with land, so you could go and move from the city to the countryside and farm it. I'm sure it was World War II, just in my head, from what they were wearing. So like in the 50s and 60s, they were trying to push this British agriculture kind of movement and getting people out of the cities where there weren't many jobs because the economy was ruined, and back to the countryside where there weren't enough people to work on the countryside.
Yeah.
Do you think that's... Number one, do you think that actually happened, or have I just made that up in my head? And number two, do you think that's kind of the process that we could go down as an option?
I think you're... I don't know about that. I haven't got the... I don't know about history. You could be right. I think that we do need to reprioritize the way that we need to reimagine rural jobs as something that has value in society. You know, in our society, we worship, you know, bankers and you know,
money and materialism.
Exactly. The things that like this, like higher level jobs that are called higher level jobs because they're quote unquote useful. They're the ones that the most that people believe create the most value. But the real value is created in the field. You know, without food, we wouldn't be able to survive. And I think that we need to find a way most people, you know, they grow up in rural society and they leave it because it's dull and people are quite separated and they're getting older and older. There's less young people there. But if there was a way of inspiring, and lots of people want, more and more people do want to go back onto the land and get involved, but if there's a way of equipping them more with investment and money and a bit of support to go back, work with the people, the community's already there, because they've got lots of skills that need to be harvested and gained, and create this sort of thriving resurgence of like putting back valuable jobs into the countryside. You know, you go to the countryside now, and all the footpaths that used to be around that could connect the farmers, they would go and visit each other. They've grown over. I know this is a bit of a weird metaphor, but like I was around living over in part of the country, not too far from where you grew up, Chris and Tessa, some farmers in east of Abergavenny, and we'd go on a walk, and there'd be all the footpaths that'd be on the map just wouldn't be there. Wow. because no one's using them anymore, because they're not, these footpaths are designed around a rural community that doesn't exist anymore.
Hmm.
And it's a weird way of thinking about it, but like I just had this idea that, like, you know, those footpaths have a history of this interaction that we used to have, this community that we used to have on the land, and those two, and that doesn't exist anymore, and so they're dying and they're becoming overgrown because no one needs them anymore. And I think that's sort of almost a metaphor of our rural society. We need to like build back those connections with people, and like what you're talking about, you know, when you used to go and help out and do hay baling and stuff, like maybe that still happens. Does it still happen? Is there like, do you know?
As far as I know, yeah, because I imagine those machines that you can run, you know, solar, they're probably quite expensive. So people just use what they've already got.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just imagining the stubborn old farmers that I know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the also thing about Wales is I think there's a bit more of a smaller farming culture in Wales than there is in other parts of the country, which I think, you know, is, you know, it does have some advantages in terms of it being, having a bit more of that connection with the people around it.
I suppose, I mean, there's been a few things in my life that have changed, similar to you, a bit of a crisis of what I'm going to do with my life, you know, since probably the last 5 years, 6 years, 28 to... you know, I'm 34 now, just deciding what to do with my life. And there was a few real key moments for me. And one was I just decided randomly to learn French. And one of the tips was watch something on TV that's in French verbally, but with English subtitles, as opposed to the other way around. Mm-hmm. So you want to be hearing the French and kind of trying to keep up with those English subtitles kind of help. And I watched Chef's Table France on Netflix. Have you seen that?
I haven't, no.
The first episode, mate, was like this Michelin star chef, and he ran a steakhouse, and he went, and he'd already got his Michelin star, and he went, I'm going to run a vegetarian restaurant. And everyone was like, no, what are you doing? And like, you're crazy. And he was like, might be crazy, you know, that kind of French way. He was like, I'm just going to go and do it.
Great, I love it.
So his routine was like, he went to the garden, he picked his like vegetables from his own garden for the day. He went back to his house. He had his own kind of straw, and then he would start his fire and start like smoking things, and then kind of heating up his kitchen. And then he'd decide what he was going to do for the day. And then he'd go to his restaurant and he'd be like, right, we can make this meal and this meal because these are the vegetables I've got today. And then the next day would be different. But his routine was always the same. And I just thought, wow, it must be so nice to just wake up and go to your own garden and pick whatever's there and just eat it. You know, it's kind of like the decision making's gone, but also like it's a bit of a lucky dip, like, oh, what's going to happen today? Rather than I'm going to go and have some Weetabix and, you know, and some kind of processed milk or whatever. And then the other thing was I read a book called Walden by David Thoreau. Have you read that?
I haven't.
I can't remember when it was written. I feel like it was like early 1900s. And he kind of leaves the town and decides to just live off the land and become self-sufficient. And it's kind of quite poetic of like, well, you could see the stars again and I can hear the birds. But it was also about how the people in the town thought he was just some crazy whack job living on his own in a log cabin. And it was like, I was like, right, if in business, right, there's a good rule that if everyone's doing it, it's probably the wrong thing to do. So you always want to be kind of the renegade. And so I started thinking, right, if this guy's got a Michelin star at stakes and he's deciding to go back to the land, if Walden's all about going back to the land, I started thinking about it. And then the final thing that crystallized it was I was watching Escape to the Chateau. Not sure if you've seen that.
I think I might have flicked onto it. I haven't watched it.
With Dick Strawbridge and his epic moustache. And his wife Angel. And I just thought, this is it. This is like, they can speak French, they've got a garden, they can actually make money from their home. They were having like hosting weddings, hosting events, people come to their garden picking foods. They traveled the UK doing seminars on, you know, how to be self-sufficient and kind of make your own things. And they've got Airbnb tents and kind of glamping pods and things. I thought, what a brilliant way to live, to just live off your own land, but also use the internet. You know, you don't have to go back in time. You can be like, right, Airbnb, right, let's have some weddings on here, but also have that lifestyle of every day wake up and kind of tend your own land and have your own little bit of, and I don't know if that's egotistical in the old Marxist way of all kind of property is theft. Maybe it's very privileged to have that kind of thing, but that is my goal. That was during the lockdown. So the last 18 months, I'd say that's been my focus of, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. That's where I want to get to.
Yeah. So it's an amazing plan. Yeah. It's a really good, amazing plan. I think, I like the idea. I mean, it's hard. It's something that's like a challenge to find those places, those beautiful places that you want, because in your head you see the shows like Escape to the Chateau and you want them, but then you don't really realize how much money is like there behind people to get those places.
Yeah.
So I find it frustrating because I have a similar dream to you, and I've been trying to find land and like that place to do run that Airbnb and have this that mark garden and stuff. But like, I'm not trying to discourage you, because you will get there and you'll find a way of doing it. You know, it's just a matter of like figuring it out. But it's just so frustrating because you come up against these people who have you realize how unequal the land is in this country, and in other countries, and then how people have it, just like it becomes
natural. It's becoming really ageist, like hating on old people for all
exactly
they've got so land grubbing.
Well, they're just like born with a, you know, silver spoon in the mouth, haven't they? They don't understand how easy it is. Oh, we'll just, you know, we'll buy a second home in France and it'll have a lovely little barn and we'll convert and we don't have to worry about if we'll get planning permission or not, because it will happen one day, because we can just, if not, we can buy somewhere else. But yeah, no, it's a great dream. I you know, And I've seen people doing it. You can buy, especially the thing that, well, the kind of the quirk of the, some of the problems in Europe, in the sense of the rural communities in Europe are dying. So the upside of that is that there's quite really cheap properties going in places like Portugal and the Pyrenees and other parts of the world. Yeah. So if you can create a business model out of it, which brings people there on holiday or yoga retreats or gym retreats or whatever, then, you know, hopefully you can, regenerate the area, but obviously you've got to do it. I believe that when you do that, the beauty of it is doing it in a way that works with the community that's already there. So you're not just like,
classic not just British expat.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And I'm sure you would anyway, but, and it's great that you don't, for the fact that you're learning French is like, is part of that, right? It's that process of like being part of the community and being able to interact with them. But like, I think it would be amazing to do that and learn, like, figure out a way of tapping into that old boy of a network of French in rural society, because that or whatever, Portuguese or whatever, because there must be some amazing people in those communities as well who if you do it right will be really pleased to have new energy and new blood in those communities, because they thrive, they really want it, right, don't they?
That's a big part of that Escape to the Chateau program is he's getting favors off the local farmers, and you know, he's doing his like broken French and then he'll go around and help them with his engineering skills and things like that. So yeah, it definitely works both ways. And my dad, because of being in the army for so long and working abroad and everything, he's like the barter master. Like it's embarrassing. Every time we go and buy anything, he'll always try and get a discount. It just doesn't work in the UK. People just think you're rude, don't they? But yeah, we grew up like, you know, we'll go and cut your tree down and chop it up for firewood if you'll give us those bricks, kind of thing. So, right. You know, having, much like you, left Abergavenny to try and find a career and build a life for myself, it's gone full circle in a very biblical prodigal son kind of way of everything you actually wanted was there in the first place. So I often think it's a case of not necessarily maturity, but I think just time, just... you've got to have that time in your teens and 20s to focus on whatever your passion is. And then you get to a point where you realize, and the point of this podcast is a lot of people's careers eventually makes them unhappy, because you get to a point where the initial passion is overtaken by obligation and you're kind of stuck in a sedentary kind of lifestyle, bad food, loads of stress. And then you add in the pressures of, I've got to get a new Range Rover and I've got to get a big house for my kids. And those things, they don't exist. And a big part of my awakening has been getting out of debt, you know, trying to sell the car, don't have car finance anymore. I'm kind of waiting a few months, but then in December, it's all going to be, the equity is going to be there. And then I'm out. And that was for the last 7 years I've had car finance. Do you know what I mean? Like, because when I was 26 or whatever, I was just like, I'm getting a BMW because I want to be like seen as a successful business owner. And having been near bankruptcy, it's really not important. It actually becomes such a burden on your life that you're phoning the car finance company, like trying to get an extension and juggling things. And it's ruined my credit score. And for what? Just to look cool in a car. But I don't think I would have realized that, you know, at the time, if someone walked in just as I was about to buy the BMW, hey, stop, have this 500, this £500 Ford Fiesta instead, you know, you'll thank me for it. I think you've got to learn from experience. Same with friends. Like, I think that our friendship group, I feel like we're a lot closer the last 2 years than we were 6 or 7 years ago. A bit of that's probably like technology, but also I think we've realized this is the friendship group. Like, it's really difficult to make friends as you get older. So like you say, having things like a community hub, you know, even an allotment or something, if you can get on the waiting list and get one, I think that's really important, because there is nothing else. Like in Instagram and WhatsApp and, you know, even video calls, it's no substitute for actually being in the room with someone and feeling that energy. So whether that is spirituality or just there's an element of human communication, body language or temperature, or there's something that you can't quite experience
Everyone's experienced that like dead eye feeling after like even a connecting conversation like this. You go away and you don't feel like
scrambles your brain.
Yeah, you don't feel like you've had a connection. You feel like yesterday I had a meal of friends on a table and it's just like the most. It filled me up, you know, not just my belly, but like my soul. And it was just like, this is what I miss, you know, just chewing the cud with a bunch of mates around some food, you know. You don't get that so much. We haven't had that for 2 years, you know. So I hear that. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted your
thought. No, it's fine. I was just ranting. There's no end to my rant. That comes off me. I think let's kind of round it up. How I'd like to round it up is, let's just say, what would your, how do you expect urban farming, market gardening, you know, food supply, what's the optimistic vision over the next, you know, 10 to 20 years for that? Where can you see it going and where would you like it to go?
Ooh, big question. I would love there to be like a celebration and like a more of a resurgence of interest in local supply chains. So we have more support from the government to create a flourishing network of smaller market gardens that are based around cities. And so encouraging people from all walks of life to be employed by those farms, it's not just a certain type of person. Whereby more people are getting employment on those farms. So we're boosting the economy and giving people valuable work that where they're fairly paid for those jobs, they're not exploited anymore. And that would be an amazing thing to like could have more places like that organically that I talked about at the beginning, you know, that where farms that are create more and more farms like that are created in communities that don't just provide they provide a social function as well as a productive function. So my dream would be that supermarkets, they still exist, they're still useful for some certain things, and I get people have busy lives and need to be convenient, have convenience, but the supermarkets have less and less power, and what instead replaces them is thriving farmers markets, like box schemes that people pick up the vegetables from either the farm or it's delivered to them, but they might visit where they're going to find out what's going on about it. You've got volunteer days that you can go and pick your own vegetables, have a fire at the end or some sort of soup or feast that brings people in. You've got farmers that are supported to work with nature rather than work against it. So you're planting trees on the farm, you're planting different types of plants that attract beneficial insects, which pollinate and eat pests. And create that biodiversity and wildlife, which is encouraging the bird life, which is encouraging everything. I see, like, it would be amazing to have that future whereby we have, like, I think, you know, it's not impossible. You know, you look at Italy, look at France. They still have those farmers' markets every Saturday. People religiously go to, and the people, like, the farmers have been that like, all sorts of different people are like making money out of it. Probably
to be fair, I've seen a few pop up in Manchester over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. They're becoming more frequent,
I think, and that's great, you know. And in Manchester, there's this thing called the Kindling Farm. Have you heard of that?
No.
So the Kindling Farm, this is actually like would be amazing if there was like 100 Kindling Farms in the UK, because it's the most amazing, like, inspiring stories. The Kindling Trust, set up about 10 years ago, by a few people that I know through the food movement. There's a woman called Helen Woodcock, who's a really inspiring woman. But they've been, for the last 10 years, they've been doing various different projects, all about like the sort of things we're talking about, like working, getting people, this had like a land army, like getting people out to volunteer on farms to like collect vegetables that are going to go to waste, or to like just help out in different times. They had different social functions, different community things, like helping people access food on low incomes and other things. But after 10 years of like working at Helen and others have really wanted to set up a farm. And so they ran this share scheme, this community share scheme where people could buy, like, the minimum investment was £200. And the maximum was, like, I don't know, you could have probably tens of grand or whatever. But, you know, people were buying into this farm. They got a business model, and they had a plan to buy a farm near Manchester, which would be the social centre, a bit like Organically that I talked about, but like,
yeah.
They managed to get over £1 million of money from the communities, lots of different, like, I think about, like, I'm not exactly sure, but about 300 or so different investors. I put 200 quid in just to be part of it. And all those investors are getting return. They're getting 3 to 5, I think it's about 3% or something back on their money. Wow. It's more than the interest rate that you can get from the bank right now.
Yeah.
But it's also, they've got this two chunk of money now with which to buy this farm. They're going to call the Kindling Farm. And they had a farm lined up, but that fell through. But all the money is still there. So they're going to find the next one. And it's going to be, they're going to create this amazing local economy in Manchester that's selling to restaurants, selling to local producers that have it, that has a social centre on the farm that people can visit. So you should check it out. I mean, it's
yeah, I'll keep an eye on it. I'll get down there when it's open. I mean, do you think, to kind of give people practical steps that they could do to improve their mood and their health and their lifestyle, do you think a big action is go and visit a farm with a market garden and kind of see definitely where your food's coming from? Try and get out of supermarkets and support your local economy.
There's loads of different initiatives out there that where you can attract the people. Farms, there's things called CSAs, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And it's generally a farm which is owned by the community and owned by its members. So you become a member of that farm and you pay a membership fee, and in return, your dividend is food. But you also, sometimes you pay in, you have volunteer days and that you can meet people through there. So you can check out, you can Google community supported agriculture in your town and you might find one nearby. There's also something called, a bit bigger than this, but LEAF, which is an NGO, does a thing called Open Farm Sunday. And then that through that network, all the farmers have these open days where you can go visit them and find out about what they're doing. And I would recommend that very much for getting an idea of a bit more traditional farming community that are the less sort of radical types that you tend to find in the CSA movement and the market garden movement. But
like, what was that last one called? Sorry.
Open Farm Sunday. And I really, that's the one thing I've really valued from my last job is it's opened me up to the farming community that before I may have been in danger of vilifying because, like, I think, oh, they're just like corporate people that work with high inputs and nitrogen fertilizer and all things. But like, once you meet those people and you put a face to this entity that you think they are, you realize that they are very such passionate people that want to make a difference and want to produce food for their communities. They may have some things they're stuck in, like we talked before, like the debts and other things, but it's great to like just meet people, and Open Farm Sunday is a good way of doing that. Just get out, like get an allotment, talk to the people around you in that allotment. There's a great way of meeting a diverse number of people around you because it's a very diverse people, all sorts of walks of life have allotments.
As we were talking a few months ago, down with lawns and get some raised beds in your garden.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The lawns.
If you're lucky enough to have a garden.
Yeah, exactly. And there's loads of things involved. Pretty much every town and city will have some sort of community food project. And it does help. Sometimes it takes a bit of a push to get out of there because it's a bit, you're making yourself a bit vulnerable, aren't you? You know, you're going out to a new thing or you're having to meet strangers or whatever. But it is, it's always valuable to do it. You always come back thinking like, you know, that's great. I had a good chat or I managed to learn something about a vegetable I didn't know or whatever.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'll make a list of all those resources and put it on the blog with the podcast.
Yeah. If you're a teacher as well, there's a thing called FaceTime a Farmer.
Cool.
I know a few teachers,
I'll get them on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you can get these regular appointments with farmers in your class, and you FaceTime, and they take you through the class through what they're doing. It's quite a nice connection. Yeah,
that's really cool. we need to get those footpaths between farms up and running again as well.
We do. Yeah. Yeah.
There's four farmers to go and see the mates. That's cool, man.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Something I've always done is go to country fairs because, you know, I've always had dogs and been into hunting and things back in Wales. I don't do it now, but every time I come back from that and you've seen like the biggest vegetable competition or you've seen like the, you know, the dog shows and, you know, the farm kind of agricultural companies are out there and everything. It is a nice community feel and totally. I always go to those. What I've noticed though is I'm gonna do a bit of a diss. The Cheshire Game Fair this year that was all like Range Rovers and Audis and BMWs and kind of people in really posh wellies and wax jackets and those little fluffy spaniel poodle crosses.
Like, it's a problem with the countryside, right? It's become torrified a little bit.
It's like a trendy thing. And honestly, there was no normal country things there. They were just like, it was like a circus. It was like the birds of prey, the chainsaw sculpting things. And that was it. There was no like, there was no produce.
Sheep shearing race or whatever.
Mate, come on. There was no pig wrestling, there was no competition, there was no rodeo.
Geese herding. I love the geese herding.
Yeah, it is good. The natural way tends to be the way with least damage. Thanks, man. That was really good. I'll put all those links in. And where can people find out about what you do and kind of follow you or the company that you work for?
So I have a Twitter, but I don't post on it much, but it's Dan_Isles is my Twitter handle. I run the communications for an organization called Innovative Farmers, which is all about trying to work with farmers and researchers to create innovation on farms towards the ecological things we're talking about, to support those farmers to do that. So follow if you follow again iFarmers, it's called, I think it's iFarmers on at iFarmers at Twitter, or go on the website. www.innovativefarmers.org, and you'll see a lot of the results of my work. I'm not very visible on that because I'm the behind the scenes person, but through that you can see a lot of the interesting things going on in the farming community right now to try and work towards that world that we talked about, and there's some videos that go out there and various other things that I do, some of them a bit technical because the audience is a farmer audience, but I do also try and make that a bit more accessible. I also work more generally for the Soil Association on their farming communication. So have a look at the Soil Association website and find out what they're doing. And Google, if you want to see some of the work, some of the stuff that I've worked on, there's a film called Agroforestry in the UK on YouTube. And that'll give a bit of an idea about some of the cool things that I've gone to visit, some of the farms that are doing some amazing things with trees and nature. And we're going to release a new film, in a couple of weeks' time called Agroforestry in the Uplands, which is a similar idea, but looking at farms a bit higher up that are more livestock-based. Check them out.
Wow, loads to go through. Thanks, Dan. Yeah. Thanks again for doing this. And, yeah, really interesting conversation. There's definitely a few little bullet points and actions that I'll put in the notes and loads of things for people to follow and actually get out there in the community and do. So I think it's really important conversation, and one that initially I wasn't sure, you know, is it lifestyle, is it health and mindset, but it is, you know, it's what,
it's everything,
your community, it's mental health, it's the
food, politics,
it's politics, it's life.
Yeah thanks, Dan. I really enjoyed it, actually. I was a bit hesitant because I wasn't sure was that how it would go, but I've had a really good conversation, so I appreciate your questions.
Me too. Thanks, man. Thanks again for doing it. And hopefully talk to you soon, and welcome to come on in the future.
We'll have to do part two. From your chateau and my garden hub.
Yeah. Live stream from the chateau.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, man. Take care.
Joel, thanks a lot.